This is Sustainable East End, a show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, co-producer with Tony Ernst. On today's Sustainable East End, we talk with Kevin McAllister of the advocacy group Defend H2O about two issues vital to preserving Long Island's coastal areas and the wildlife that inhabits it. As sea level rises, more coastal property is at risk of going underwater. So pressure is increasing on local authorities to allow the construction of walls and other hard structures to hold back the sea. But as we hear next from coastal resilience expert and advocate Kevin McAllister, that's a bad idea. Shoreline hardening, as it's called, causes faster erosion of adjacent areas, threatening public lands and private property. Suffolk County, New York has adopted guidelines for a more environmentally friendly approach to protect against sea level rise called living shorelines. But as Kevin McAllister learned when he attended a meeting of the Suffolk County Council on Environmental Quality, those guidelines are not always being honored. He was there to give testimony on another issue having to do with pesticide use in local waters, but was shocked to learn about the council's plans to greenlight shoreline hardening.
This was a November meeting I attended to address the county's vector control practices, specifically the use of the pesticide methoprene that they spray over the marshes. I was surprised to see county park officials with their consultant represent a shoreline hardening project at Indian Island County Park in Riverhead on Flanders Bay as a living shoreline project. This is, in fact, the antithesis to living shorelines. The concept behind living shorelines is really to provide the ability for these shorelines to migrate. There is components that incorporate some stone for breakwaters to dissipate wave energy behind them to reestablish marsh lands, but ultimately allowing for the system to move and migrate. And particularly with what we can expect on sea level rise to keep these natural shorelines intact, there's support for the bay ecology, public access. You know, we have to allow, again, migration. And one of the primary components that they weren't really focusing on, you know, it was almost a matter of fact, was a very lengthy bulkhead that was behind the breakwaters and the plantings to basically protect this headland from further erosion. And over time, with sea level rise, the marsh will drown because it will not be able to migrate landward. At some point in time, we will obliterate that shoreline. This is an active nesting site for horseshoe crabs. I know that from just presence and use of the park itself. So we're talking about ecological implications, human implications that, you know, it'd be no longer available to walk the beach, so to speak. And, you know, I think what's really disturbing here is there are absolutely no infrastructure or structures that are threatened in this park. It's basically a natural area. So, I think it's really important that as a principal partner to the Peconic Estuary Program that subscribes to a no net increase in shoreline hardening, actually a goal to reduce what's out there, that Suffolk County would be a sponsor in a project that is hardening the shoreline.
What did you find? Did you say anything when you were there? Did you speak against it?
Oh, absolutely. I took my opportunity to define what living shorelines, what that concept means. And they're very specific that, you know, we're trying to move away from shoreline hardening. And this, again, had a primary component was hardening the shoreline with the bulkhead. So I certainly spoke against it. Fortunately, the Council on Environmental Quality, they were listening. It took another meeting coming back in December, and this time with another local that was very passionate about the park and its natural state. Both of us spoke, and we had some influence in persuading the Council on Environmental Quality members to recognize that, again, this was not, in fact, a living shoreline, and this was a contradiction to, again, the goals that we're trying to achieve in shoreline protection. So they, I'll say, influenced the sponsor, County Parks, to withdraw the application. That's good news, but I do know, I believe the application was made for permit with the DEC. I'm trying to determine whether or not that permit application has been withdrawn. And I will say the county official that represented the project was very adamant about the bulkhead being part of this project. It was almost a bit of a deal breaker. So I'm concerned that it will reappear, perhaps with a permit in hand from the state, and almost trying to maneuver and position the CEQ to go along with a really bad project.
So the DEC, first of all, tell us who that is or what that is. And then why do you think that they would be pushing something of this kind?
The DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation, this is New York State. They are the regulatory authority for basically wetland permits and shoreline permits. So if you're seeking to restore a marsh or put in a stone revetment or bulkhead, you will have to obtain their permits, their permission. They are ultimately the principal decider of whether or not this project goes through. I'm concerned, and I've seen this with a propensity of bulkheads. You know, I cited the Peconic Estuary Program's objectives and goals to basically limit additional hardening. And I will tell you with certainty, within the last 10 years, there's been cumulative miles of new structure that has been placed in the Peconic Estuary. Again, in contradiction to this essentially non-binding decree. No one's paying attention. I certainly am. I know where these structures have been placed. I've been fighting to stop other structures from coming in. And I'm afraid, but I know with certainty the pressure to put in walls will only increase as sea level rises. People are unwilling, property owners are unwilling to lose real estate. And in many cases, as is the case of Indian Island County Park, this is about just real estate loss. We're not talking about necessarily people's homes on the precipice of, you know, a bluff that's falling in and, oh my gosh, we got to do something to save the home.
Aren't people's homes real estate?
They are real estate, but I'm talking just the physical property, whether it be a lawn, a woodland area, you know, on the top of these bluffs in particular, and some of the projects I've seen that have already been armored. There have been no structures that have been threatened. And the bluff lands, because they're sediment banks, if you will, they're so important that they'll be allowed to give up the material to basically replenish beach sand to maintain a natural shoreline. So there's a intertidal zone. Again, with the walls in place over time, you know, with the impact and reflective wave energy, we'll end up losing that intertidal zone. And then there's biological impacts to species such as horseshoe crab, which are essentially threatened in the Mid-Atlantic region as we speak.
Not to speak of the fact that properties to either side of the hardening are going to be eroded more quickly, isn't that correct?
That term is called end scour, and it's very typical when you have a bulkhead or stone revetment. The ends of these structures cause the accelerated erosion of what would have been natural shoreline. So it really compels the adjacent property owners to follow suit with structure. And over time, you know, it's connected dots, essentially, where more walls lead to additional walls on the ends. And we keep going where we have, you know, large reaches of shoreline that become armored. And again, the biological, ecological implications, as well as loss of public access.
So let's go back for just a second. You said that, I mean, this is a guidance, the idea of living shorelines. This is a guidance. There's no actual legal obligation to conform to it?
within state regulations and policy, and unfortunately the Department of Environmental Conservation has lost their way, but there is strong policy that we're to protect natural features, these bluffs, bluff lines, the shorelines, in a natural state. And the DEC has been allowing and permitting these structures to come in pretty regularly. Living Shorelines is a guidance document and guidance to try to move away from that. So, you know, where the disconnect is really walking the talk, so to speak, where we subscribe to the tenets of Living Shorelines and ensure that, you know, we don't continue to armor. Again, as a principal partner to the Peconic Estuary Program, you know, Suffolk County has to demonstrate leadership. You know, the Parks Department, by proposing shoreline armoring project under the guise of Living Shoreline, number one, it's the antithesis of Living Shorelines. And more importantly, when we're asking property owners around the Peconic Basin to subscribe to, again, Living Shorelines and the concept, only to don't look over here when we put in a big wall, because we want to protect real estate, you know, this is misguided thinking.
So tell us, how should this be done? I mean, describe what a living shoreline is, and then what can we do to pressure our county officials to actually follow through and take leadership on this?
A couple of the components. The project had three sills or breakwaters. These were submerged natural stone that would be placed offshore in the water column. Behind it, they were going to backfill with more sediment and then revegetate. So ultimately, in a high energy zone, which this location is, when you consider the fetch of Flanders Bay, ultimately, this provides some protection for establishment of the marsh behind it. But over time, again, we've got to allow that marsh to migrate landward. So, you know, we cannot include a large bulkhead structure that would impede that migration. You know, this is really important, and I think where we are, I'm starting to see the term living shoreline hijacked by some of the consultants, where stones and what is really walls being placed in it, all its forms, you know, whether it be stone or vertical, you know, if we call them a living shoreline, then, you know, through the permitting process, they can slide through. Oh, that's great. Well, it's not, in fact, a living shoreline. It's deviating from the concepts and the theme. And I'm afraid that, you know, we've got to stem this right now. We got to stop it in its tracks before we regret the day that we've allowed these to come in.
You mentioned the DEC before. Could they trump the decision, say, by the Council on Environmental Quality not to give the permit?
CEQ urged the Parks Department to withdraw the application. So as it stands, the county CEQ is not going along with the project. My understanding, they submitted an application to DEC. I've been calling their offices trying to get confirmation there's an application, because I want to comment on it formally if there is. Absolutely, DEC is the final authority, the final say on this. And, you know, there has to be public scrutiny and public pressure on their activities to ensure, again, they're adhering to long-established coastal policy that goes back to the 1980s that, you know, is intent on protecting natural shorelines. And there should be no trade-off or no consideration, particularly if we don't have people's homes that are being threatened. And again, I find it unacceptable to install these walls just for the sole purpose of protecting someone's lawn.
This is Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Next, we talk with Kevin McAllister of Defend H2O about another issue vital to our coastal areas. In an effort to kill mosquitoes, Suffolk County's Vector Control has been spraying marshlands with methoprene, a chemical recognized as lethal to some marine life that plays a critical role in the wildlife food chain. Methoprene has been banned in Connecticut for use in coastal areas, but so far not in New York. Kevin McAllister of the environmental watchdog group Defend H2O has been calling for an end to the spraying for several years. Recently, Suffolk County responded to calls from local political leaders to end the practice, with a so-called trial ban on the spraying at one location. I talked with Kevin McAllister recently about the controversy.
My familiarity with methoprene dates back to around 2002. That's when really I started to inform myself of their practices, both for the wetland manipulations for mosquito ditching, the trenching in wetlands to drain water off, and then the chemical applications. And I became familiar with this larvicide methoprene. Its trade name is Altacid. And this is routinely sprayed by helicopter over the salt marshes. It's intended to get into the water. The county generally treats from May through September, October-ish, and it's based on the tidal cycles. So the full moon and new moons, when the marshes are flooded, generally that's when they are applying the methoprene to get it into the water column, and then ultimately it interferes with the larval stage mosquito and prevents the larvae from developing into flying mosquitoes.
So this has happened for mosquitoes. Now, the Suffolk County says that methoprene poses, quote, no significant human toxicity, and that they're doing this in order to prevent, you know, serious illness such as West Nile virus. What's your response to this?
I don't dispute the county's assertion that, you know, there's no risk to human health. I'm not a physician, so I can't speak to that. The biological implications to non-target insects and crustaceans, there are real impacts based on multiple studies. And what's key here, you know, the county claims that they're protecting human health from West Nile and Eastern equine encephalitis. And I can tell you that the disease does not exist in the larval form of mosquitoes. So that's very misleading to suggest that they're, you know, they're suppressing disease when the, again, the effect of this chemical, this pesticide on the mosquito larvae does not carry disease. So they're, you know, they're misleading the public. I also feel there's a great deal of fear-mongering in trying to raise hysteria to justify, which is principally a nuisance control program. They're spraying these marshes not necessarily to save lives, but rather just keep the mosquito populations down so, you know, communities can enjoy backyard barbecues and not, you know, not have the nuisance problem around, you know, water bodies.
I'm going to come right back to its effects on the non-target insects and fish. But before we do that, just go a little further into this. I mean, you say it's not present in the larval form of mosquitoes, but nonetheless, mosquitoes do carry it. So if they are not wiping out mosquitoes by getting to the larva, what other ways are there to suppress West Nile virus?
Well, and what's also important to note, the West Nile is carried in a freshwater form of mosquitoes. We're essentially treating saline conditions. It's a different mosquito that is not the carrier. So that's misleading there, as well as because of sheer numbers of mosquito populations, the flying mosquitoes, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a propensity for disease. Birds are part of the vector in the transmission process. So they're taking liberty in suggesting that they are, in fact, keeping disease down by controlling mosquito populations. I would disagree with that. I would further say the collateral damages to, you know, the other life, again, the non-target insects and crustaceans, where the studies have clearly shown that, you know, there's a significant reduction in those populations, you know, that's too high of an impact for, you know, suggested mosquito control.
Well, let's get to that right now. Let's get to some of them. First of all, you have talked about the impact on both insects and fish. Let's take the fish first. Tell us, what are the impacts on fish and shellfish?
Well, it's crustaceans. That's what the studies that I have reviewed. And to the animal kingdom, arthropods is a class or a phylum of animals. And within that, you have two classes, insectia, so the class of insects, and then crustaceans. So these are like organisms. Ultimately, the effectiveness on insects, so the mosquito larvae as basically a insect growth regulator, is having the same effect on larval stage crustaceans. And there's a principal researcher, Dr. Michael Horst, who's done extensive work looking at the implications to blue crab and American lobster. And at the larval stages within both species, exposure to methoprene is seeing significant reductions in those numbers. So it's lethal to, again, larval form of blue crab and lobster. And, you know, I've seen further in the literature looking at mud crabs and fiddler crabs. So, the world of crustacea, grass shrimp, all of these forms of organisms are at risk from exposure to methoprene.
Does that include horseshoe crabs?
That's in there as well, yes.
So that's interesting because, when I was a kid and a young woman out here on the East End, horseshoe crabs were, or their skeletons were common sight on the beaches, and I have not seen a horseshoe crab now in, at least a decade. Could methoprene be one of the reasons?
No, I don't think that's the case. I really think the loss of habitat with the bulkheading of shorelines, so they're losing their nesting beach, their nesting areas, as well as there's a high demand on the commercial side of things. So further review would have to really look into that. So I wouldn't say it with a broad brush that, you know, there's a correlation there.
But there is, you say, with lobsters. Now, I thought that lobster populations have crashed here on the east end of Long Island because of warming waters due to climate change. Is methoprene also a factor?
It potentially is. I will say there was a study done out of Connecticut, ultimately saw an adulticide resmethrin that's a pyrethroid that is sprayed to kill flying mosquitoes, as well as methoprene were identified in lobsters that were sampled. Again, this is really at the lower life stages. I think the real effect on lobster populations is climate change and warming water temperatures, but it certainly has prompted the state of Connecticut to ban methoprene use in all coastal areas. That was done in 2013. And that is state legislation. And they have defined their coastal areas, by virtue of mapping. You know, these are all the communities that would drain into Long Island Sound. And that was a very far-reaching law that, again, prohibits methoprene use in those areas. And further, Senator Christopher Murphy, one of the U.S. senators from Connecticut, after that legislation was passed, had asked Governor Cuomo to follow suit with respect to New York and asking for a ban for, within New York to, ultimately help to benefit, the management action for Long Island Sound.
And what has been the response of Governor Cuomo?
There has been no response, and I have been in communication with Senator Murphy's office to request a follow-up to that letter. I will say locally on the legislative side, Assemblyman Fred Thiel, and I believe this has been co-sponsored by Senator Kenneth LaValle, They have a bill in that's been reintroduced that would seek a state ban on methaprine, but that has to move through, you know, the legislative process on an annual basis.
Which moves like molasses.
Correct, yes.
Now, I'm curious, what is the difference between Connecticut and New York? Why has Connecticut been able to ban methaprine, and why has New York not?
Well, there was a very active fisherman community in Connecticut, and I will say I was instrumental in providing a great deal of information in prior years to support their efforts, and you know, they ultimately got the attention of the elected officials. I don't think they, you know, the municipalities, on whether it be a local level or county level, you know, have the entrenched bureaucracy that Suffolk County does around this program that, you know, has existed for quite some time.
And since it sounds like, or at least you say, that methaprine is not particularly effective in controlling disease like West Nile virus or equine encephalitis, then why are they using it?
Largely because of nuisance control. And I have been involved in this issue for quite some time, you know, have through the Freedom of Information Act have obtained a number of documents with respect to their annual work plans and other communications. And early on, I'll say some years ago, they were, you know, openly representing that, you know, this was largely about basically knocking back the mosquito populations for comfort level within the communities. And if you look at their annual work plan, what really triggers the spraying applications is the number of phone calls and complaints from the public. And then second on that list is requests from elected officials. So what's really driving this is complaints rather than the incidence of disease that's out there.
Now, and you mentioned official, you know, local politicians' complaints. I know local politicians out here in East Hampton and Southampton have opposed the use of methaprine. Have they complained about its use?
Well, they have, but I will say without real, not necessarily vigorously. I have, again, participated in the process. You know, I've watched legislators, you know, publicly state that, you know, they're concerned about the spraying and, you know, but ultimately then will vote in favor of the approval of the annual work plan that includes the spraying of methaprine and other toxic chemicals and essentially shield their, you know, their position with concern about West Nile, and which, again, is a misplaced concern.
This is Sustainable East End. We heard Kevin McAllister of Defend H2O. More information about pollutants in our bays and estuaries and the work of Defend H2O can be found at defendh2o.org. You can also find a link to their petition to stop methaprine spraying. Sustainable East End programs are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.